accession number 18666, Reel 2.
Brian Bass, Reel 2.
And that providing you did attempt to do whatever they ask, no problems. After 4 weeks basic training, we were then allocated to varied trade training. And we went out to outside camp and paraded. And about 100 of us, I think, were going to be trained as operator, wireless and line. We marched from Catterick camp, the 2 to 3 miles up to Richmond in Yorkshire, past Richmond, up the hill to a camp on the hills behind called Gallagate. And this turned out to be rather an exposed spot when the weather got cold. But anyway, we arrived at Gallagate camp, having marched from Catterick, expecting to start our trade training. But we were disillusioned. When we got there, we were told that the CO, a three training regiment, had decided that we had to do 2 weeks fatigues before we started our trade training. Nobody knows what this involved. But we were kept waiting a bit, and eventually I found myself on a lorry going with others, going back down to Catterick. And we went to the headquarters of the three training regiment, which is Burloin Lines. What I was going to do for the next fortnight, I didn't know, but I soon found out. I found myself with a few others in the fuel compound, shoveling coke into sacks for distribution to the married quarters. Now, you must appreciate that if I hadn't been called up, I would have been working as an electrician, earning £6 to £7 a week. And here I was in the army, shoveling coke into sacks, getting £1.05 a week. Not a happy thought. But the fortnight soon went, and it was back up to Gallagate for trade training. Now, this consisted mainly of learning the phonetic alphabet and the Morse code. A for able, B for baker, and the Morse code for it. A, able, dida, baker, da dida. Could you just stop that a minute? I'll make a cocker.
It doesn't make any difference.
It's Abel did that, Baker did it, Charlie did it. Now we were in room, sort of rain, just like going back to infant school. There would be an easel with the letter A and the more symbols underneath it, and we would repeat it like you would in school. And that's, we would work our way through the alphabet. Abel did that, Baker did it, Charlie did it. Until we'd got through the whole alphabet, learning the Morse code that way, and then it would be put out over the speakers, and we would have to write it down. Now, once we got going on the primary, past the primary stage, each week you had to take a Morse test to show that you were up to standard. Personally, I never had any problem with learning the Morse code and keeping up to standard during the course of other things we learned as well, of course, how to operate various radio sets, mainly the 19 set, all about aerials, because different type of air rod aerials, end fin aerials, dipole aerials, and so forth, battery charging. So it was a regular round of instructions, interspersed with drill, square bashing, keep fit, and other things. So the huts we were in were wooden huts, which held about 20 people. And there were five huts with the ablutions block separate. Now, these huts were very thinly insulated. And again, there was one small tortoiseshell stove in these huts. And the fuel ration for these, I think, was 2 buckets of fuel per day, per billet. There would be a billet orderly in the billet. Each day, somebody was nominated to be billet orderly. And he would light the stove about 4, half past 4. So when we come in from instructions, the stove was underway. But the amount of fuel that was issued didn't last that long, and by 9 o'clock at night it was all gone. Now, of course, when the weather got cold, and it does get very cold in Yorkshire, we had snow up there in January 1952, quite a lot of snow. To try and keep warm in the billet was difficult. So you had your blankets and, of course, your army greatcoat. Always put that over top of the bed to keep warm. Reveille was at 6:30. There was a parade on the square at 7 to make sure people were up. But it was so cold, people didn't want to get out of bed. And it was so dark outside that the orderly officer really couldn't see who was on the square. Anyway, so what used to happen was the acting lance corporal would rustle up who he could. They would put on their boots over their overcoat, over their pajamas, the boots on their feet and their beret on their head, run up through the snow and stand there in the dark. And when the orderly officer says, Peter 1, Peter 2, Peter 3, Peter 4, Peter 5, which was our troop, Peter 5, all present incorrect. He couldn't see how many were there. Then the rest of us were still in bed. And then you'd go down, get out, eventually get up because you wanted breakfast. And you had to go on works parade at 8:30, you see. So you eventually had to get up and go to the ablutions block and hope that the water wasn't frozen up so you could wash and shave. And then we go on works parade. And the square at Gallagher was right open and across the moors. And being the last troop, we were at the back. And the wind used to come across here, and believe me, it was very cold. I will say that the rooms we did our training in were warm. I can't ever recall those being cold. But the billet we were in was freezing, absolutely freezing. At night time, it could be. And of course, if you want to spend a penny during the night, you had to get in and walk through the snow to the ablutions block anyway. After about 17 weeks trade training, we took our tests. And then, on the Tuesday, after we'd taken our tests, I think on a Thursday and Friday, the sergeant said, outside Tuesday and you'll all have your postings. Great excitement, because at that time you could go anywhere really in the world with the British Army. And I was enthused. I wanted to know where I was going. And so we were lying out there, 90 of us. Some were kept back for further training because they hadn't passed, but the majority had passed their tests. And we were stood there. And people were going to Austria, Germany, Egypt, Cyprus, Singapore, Northern Ireland. 874 Bert and two others, Southern Command, next signals, Winterbourne, Dauncey, Salisbury. I could have pulled my hair out. It's me wanting to go abroad. And I'm back then, 20 odd miles from home. A couple of days later, we've given travel warrants, packed lunch. The packed lunch considered two slices of bread with a lump of bully beef in between, another two slices of bread with a lump of cheese between. He looked at the three of us and he said, "Who's the eldest?" And this other chap said, "I must be." He said, "Well, here's a shilling. You buy tea on the way down." So we then made our way from Richmond down to Salisbury by train.
Which month is this?
This would be February. We got to Salisbury Station, late afternoon, tea time, something like that. What are we going to do? Nobody here to meet us. We asked the taxi driver where Winterbourne Dauncey was. He said, "Oh, it's the other side of Salisbury, 2 or 3 miles. This chap who had the shilling, the eldest, "We're phoning up the camp," he says. So we're there, phones up the camp. "We're at Salisbury Station. Could you send somebody down to pick us up?" "How many?" "Three." "Sorry, make your own way. If you were a group of 15, I could send a truck. Or if you were WRAC, I'd send a truck. Only three of you? Get the bus." So we then said, asked somebody where we got the bus from the bundle. They said, "Up by the marketplace." So we walked from the station with our kit bags through Salisbury to the marketplace. The Silver Star Bus Company. We're waiting at the bus stop for the Silver Star bus and a Jeep rolls up. Royal Signals chap. He said, "Where are you lads off to?" "Winterbourne Dauncey, Fig Street Barracks, Winterbourne Dauncey." He said, "Where are you coming from then?" He said, "Catterick." He said, "When they come and pick you up?" "No, we've got to get the bus." "Rotten lot of so-and-sos. Jump in," he said, "I'll run you up." We jumped in his Jeep with our three of us with our kit bags, and he dropped us off outside the gate. We booked in. I thought, "I don't know, what sort of place is this I come to?" Sinn Féin, the buildings were quite good. The barrack blocks were what we call spiders. They were wooden blocks with the ablutions in the centre and the accommodation blocks off. The very next day, I think, was the day King George VI died. Because I was going to the cinema that night and they closed the cinema down. And that following Sunday, of course, we had a big church parade down in Winterbourne Dauncey Parish Church. Now, there's nothing for me to do down at Winterbourne Dauncey at Fig Street Barracks. Except in the morning, the sergeant used to call out the names of people who obviously didn't have jobs. And he said to the chap in front of me, "Guard room." Out corporate down in the guard room. He said to me, "Cookhouse." So I thought, in the cookhouse. Now, if you go in the cookhouse as a general, you get all the worst jobs, tin washing. All the regulars in it, you know, cooks do that. You wash tin wash. It's a lazy job. All the greasy tins from breakfast. You know, you spend all day because they're cooking all day, just washing tins. Next day, I was in the cookhouse again. New guardroom, new cookhouse, you know, and he went along. He had his set jobs, that, and there you lined up. Of course, you got the same job every day, really, because you lined up. The third day, the chap who was in front of me, sergeant said, "You back down the guardroom then." He said, "No, I don't want to go down the guardroom." He said, "I don't like being down there with the prisoners," he said. He said, "All right." He said to me, "You get in the guardroom, you're tall." I thought, that's better than the cookhouse. Then the guardroom I went. And that's where I stayed. Regimental policeman. We had a corporal, and there were three of us down there. Now, we had prisoners in. At different times. And they used to have to march the prisoners about and look after them. And one day, the CO said he wanted to see one of these prisoners. And I had to march him down. It was down the road, inside an internal road inside the camp. And when I got there, the RSM was there. And I marched the prisoner in before the CO. And it was about something to do about his term of incarceration. Anyway, I had to mark him marching back to the guardroom. And it was quite a few hundred yards down this road. And this lad had been on a paratrooper's course. He was quite a good deal shorter than me. He said to me, "Bert," he said, "I'll show you, I used to march in a paratrooper's course," he said. He never passed, of course, you know. So we start going down this road, and he's striding out, and I'm right behind him. We're going down a half a leather, and lunk, the other way come the SQMS. As we go, he said, "Hey, you two, stop!" And he walked over and he said to the prisoner, he said, "Hey lad, is he making you march that fast?" He says, "No, Q." He said, "What's the idea of making him march that fast?" he says to me. I just kept quiet. He then started to lecture me. He said, "The standard rate of march in the British Army is 120 paces to the minute, except the light infantry, which is 140 paces to the minute. You were marching about 160. Well, I think he was exaggerating a bit. "Now let me see you marching off back to that guardroom at the correct pace," he said. So we went off down the road at a slower pace. There are other stories I could tell you about prisoners. There were two prisoners in the guardroom at one time. And the adjutant sent instructions down that the prisoners had to go down to the office and clean the windows. So I had to march these two prisoners down to the office, the CO's office and the adjutant's office, for window cleaning. One regimental policeman in charge of two prisoners is not a good situation, really. Because what happened was this. They start cleaning windows. Then one would say, "I want to go to the loo." I couldn't leave, take one to the loo and leave the other one there, so I had to march them both round to the loo. One would go, then we'd get back, and 10 minutes later, the other one would say, "I want to go to the loo." So you had to stop and march them both round to the loo. And then one had said he'd run out of water for washing the windows and wanted refilling. And so they would just mess you a bit, really. And during this operations, we were marching down to get some, going to the toilets. And the adjutant came the other way. And I ignored him with the two prisoners. There was almighty sheep. And he said to me, "What do you think you're doing?" I said, "Sorry, sir." He says, "What do you think you're doing marching by me with the two prisoners? Without acknowledgement. I said, "I'm sorry, sir, I didn't see you." Which is a bit ridiculous, really, because we walked right by each other. He caught me by surprise. I got a right old rollicking. I had to march the prisoners back past him. Start again. March towards him. Prisoner's eyes right. Throw up a salute myself. March past and stop. That's better, he says. Don't let it happen again. And this way things went with the two prisoners. One went to the toilet, then the other one would want to go to the toilet. Anyway, they went back to the guard room. And it was while they were back at the guard room the following day that one had applied to go to Korea, and his posting had come through, and I had to march him up to the CO's office, where the CO said, "Well, McCaffrey, your posting to Korea has come through. You're to go on immediate embarkation leave, and so the rest of your sentence of 14 days detention will be rescinded." So I marched him back to the guard room, and then a short while afterwards, the CO phoned in, or the RSM phoned in, and said the CO wants to see the other prisoner. Now, these two prisoners have committed the same offence at the same time and have both got 14 days detention. So I had to march the other one back and march him in front of the CO. And the CO then informed him that, seeing as he had to rescind McCaffrey's detention, cut it short, in due fairness, he would then cut the second one's sentence short. And he was to go back to the guard room, pack his bags, and his detention would terminate. And that's when, on the way back to the guard room, he tried to outpace me, and we were doing the 160 paces to the minute. Going on from there, I'd been down at Southern Command with signals for about 3 months. And then the clerk said to me one day, he saw me and he said, "Hey Bert, how'd you like to go to Korea?" I said, "I would like that very much." He said, "Well, whether you like it or not, you're going. Look on part one orders tonight." So I looked on the orders and it's 874 Sigmund Bert will proceed on embarkation leave on such and such a date for Mercury reinforcements, was the code word they used. They didn't say you were posting Mercury reinforcements, I think it was.
Which month is this?
Which month?
Yes.
This would be May. I couldn't wait to get my bags packed quick enough, I tell you. I went home for 14 days embarkation leave. Rather proudly, I told all my friends I'm off to Korea. My relations, my mother, who was a widow, of course, didn't go much on it. Didn't like her younger son going off to war, but me, I couldn't wait to get started. The 14 days leave couldn't go by quick enough, really. This is what I wanted to do. If I've got to do national service, then this is what I wanted to do, was travel. I then, after my 14 days leave, I went down to Newton Abbott in Devon, where the Royal Signals transit camp was. Got the train down to Newton Abbott. We're there, a draft is made up, can't remember, about 40 of us, I think. And then one day they said, "Parade at 4 o'clock. And we prayed at 4 o'clock. We were then taken down to the railway station on a train for Liverpool. And I seem to remember we got to Liverpool sometime in the early hours of the morning, I think. It seemed to be an awful long train journey from Devon. We were marched down to a local barracks, or TA barracks, where we had some breakfast. And then later in the day, we were taken down to the docks and embarked on the troop ship Empire Hallidale. Great excitement. Me, I was enthralled. Couldn't wait for the boat to pull away in case somebody changed their mind. And I always remember the liner Franconia pulled out in front of us and went down the Mersey. Then it was our turn. We came out in the midstream and went off down the Mersey. The on board was the main draft was the 1st Battalion, the Royal Fusiliers, City of London Regiment. And then there was detachments of Royal Signals, Royal Military Police, Royal Electrical Mechanical Engineers and so forth. The Royal Fusiliers had the front part of the boat. the cores, detachments, and the rear part of the boat. Went down through Liverpool, from Liverpool down the channel, and across the Bay of Biscay. Weather was very kind, calm, down into the Mediterranean, just like a mill pond. Our group had been allocated some chores to do in the morning, and that was getting the stores up from the hold in the boat up to the galley. About a dozen of us did this. Manhandling sacks of potatoes onto a pulley, up through into the galley, and that was our chores for the morning. Afterwards, we were given tea and biscuits by the crew for our as a reward. And then the rest of the day, providing there were no lectures or instructions, was free time. The food was quite good. Once we'd got out of territorial waters, I used to smoke in those days, the canteen opened and they issued us tins of 50 players and a box of matches for 2 shillings, which was remarkable value. There was a canteen where you could buy tins of fruit, bearing in mind that food was still on ration in Britain at that time. In army food wasn't nothing particular, in my opinion. And so as we went down through the Mediterranean, very nice, they put the awnings up over the deck so we didn't get sunburned. There used to be record programs for over the tennis speakers. And sometimes we used to see film shows, you know, when the ship was stopped. Our first stop was Portside after about 10 days. And it was around about that time I had my 22nd birthday, because this would be in the beginning of July. We went down the Suez Canal. Great. I had to see people riding camels and donkeys and palm trees. It enthralled me. Did it in Arabs. It was just an enthralling experience. Well, on down through the through the Suez Canal into the Red Sea. Down the Red Sea, very hot because it was July, and it was very hot. And they tried to give us PT in the mornings at 7 o'clock, but after a few 5 or 10 minutes, you were quite worn out. You know, it's that hot, debilitating. Stopped at Aden. I didn't go ashore. What amused us at Aden was we used to anchor offshore there, Aden, and a young boy used to swim out and dive for coins. We used to throw him coins off the side of the boat, but he would only go for the silver coins. He wouldn't bother with the coppers, and he put them in his mouth. And then we left Aden and went across the Indian Ocean, and it got up a bit rough. And people were looking a bit green. And I thought, what's the matter with them? It was quite exciting to see the spray come all out of the bay of the boat. Until I went down to tea. And we had our tea. And we finished up with ice cream. And I left the mess deck. Went into the toilets. And that was my tea. And I could never eat ice cream for several years after that. The mere sight of ice cream used to put me off. That was the only time I was seasick, but I think everybody else on board was seasick as well. And then we went across